on a regular basis. I'm not sure if it's going to be every week, every other week, or once a month, but Yemitz Hashem will get it down to a consistent format. In any case, I will also try to use the phone and email. If you're not receiving emails, please go onto shmooz.com and put your address in. Is there anyone here who should be receiving emails and is not? Did you put your name in? Really? It might be like that anti-Semitic thing. Yeah, the smarty, anti-smarty thing. They can tell that the computer is pretty smart. Yeah. So, gentlemen, if you're not receiving it, just please send in your email again. Just re-register. I asked the webmaster to clean the list down, and I think he did. So he told me that anyone who has a Queens address in is in the Queens email. So hopefully you're getting. If you're still not receiving the emails, please just send me personally an email. That'd be the best way. One more thing also. The Shmooz on the Parsha book is still available for sale if you're interested. I have copies. Also, what just came out was the Shmooz collection. This is a collection of CDs of Shmooz 1 through 124. They come in three binders. As you'll see, again, the marketing, Shmooz marketing, almost as good as Ura. Come on, guys, right? So, in any case, this is a binder of CDs. Now, again, you guys know that you can download the Shmooz for how much? For free. Or you could pay for the CD. So why would any Jewish person pay for the CD? The answer is there are still those people who are not techno-savvy and really feel more comfortable with the CDs. But also, the CDs have a tremendous advantage. A lot of people use them for a gemach or they want to give out copies to friends, etc. So if you're interested, I have a number of sets. They come in three binders. Each binder has 40 shmuzim in it. Sets 1, 2, and 3, it's shmuzim 1 through 124. If you're interested, you could either purchase it now and or send an email to to Vinny at theshmooz.com. She can help you with that. And if you want to look at it, I'm leaving one over here. That's just a little too loud for me, though. I have to one quick sound adjustment. I'd like to thank David Blau for sponsoring the food this evening. In the time of the Roman entering Eretz Yisrael, the time when the Romans already were living, had conquered Israel, and Rabbi Kiva was the leading light in Eretz Yisrael, and there are many examples of debates that occurred between Tarnopas HaRosha and Rabbi Akiva. Tarnopas was, at that point, the monarch. He was the one who was totally responsible for Israel's fate. And he was what was known then as a soldier philosopher. He prided himself on his wisdom. He prided himself on his open-mindedness. And keep in mind that in those days, the church was not the accepted religion in the world. There was a tremendous respect for the Chachamim. And there were many debates between Tarnopas and Rabbi Akiva. The Midrash that you see in front of you is one such example. And the Midrash tells us as follows. One day, Tarnopas says to Rabbi Akiva as follows, "Why does your God hate us?" And Tarnopas quoted a pasuk. And the pasuk says as follows, "Senesius Esav, I hated Esav," asked Tarnopas, "Why is it that your God hates us?" At which point, Rabbi Akiva says to Tarnopas, "Come back to me tomorrow, and I'll tell you the answer." The next day, Tarnopas returns and asks Rabbi Akiva, "So what did you dream about last night? What did you see in your dream?" And Rabbi Akiva says to him as follows, "Last night I dreamt about two dogs. One was named Rufus and the other was named Rufina." At which point, Tarnopas became furious. His name was Rufus. Tarnopas was an honorary title. His actual name was Rufus. His wife's name was Rufina. And he took it as a direct insult. And he said to Rabbi Akiva as follows, "You're chayev misa, I should kill you on the spot for the insult to the monarch." At which point Rabbi Akiva said to him as follows, "Let me ask you, what is the difference between you and a dog? You eat and they eat. You drink, they drink. You sleep, they sleep. You will die and they die. Yet when I take a name that you have and apply it to a dog, you're insulted. You feel an affront. How much more so God, the creator of the heavens and the earth, the one who suspends this planet in its orbit, the one who created you and keeps you alive, and you call a piece of wood by the name of God, shouldn't he feel an affront? And that is how the Midrash tells us Rabbi Akiva entered to Nochlas. And I'd like to ask one simple question on this Midrash, and that is that is a very dangerous move that Rabbi Akiva just engaged in. He's talking to the monarch, the emperor, a man who would kill, literally at the drop of a hat, the man who has no regard for life, and yet Rabbi Akiva says something that's literally very, very close to insulting the man, and in fact does insult him. But even more difficult to understand is the fact that what Rabbi Akiva was trying to convey to Tarnofas was not a deep concept. What he was saying was a very simple idea. Look, you're calling God the creator of the heavens and the earth, and you're using that same name and applying it to a piece of wood. You're embarrassing God, you're causing a tremendous affront to the honor of God. What was so difficult about that concept that he had to tell him this, let me sleep on it, and he gives him the mushel about the two dogs and the names and etc. And why didn't Rabbi Akiva just simply say, what you're doing is an embarrassment to God when you use the name of God and apply it to a piece of wood? Why did he have to go through this entire scenario, and only when Tarnofas felt angry did he explain to him his meaning? And I'd like to see this evening if we could address this question and get a better understanding as to why Rabbi Akiva didn't just answer straight, but rather he went through this almost charade to answer this question. And let me begin with an interesting observation. My children have this poem that they like to quote. The poem goes something like this. A father wanted to teach his child about the marketplace. So the father gave the child a dollar. And he told the child, go out into the marketplace. And the child went out. A boy saw that he had a dollar. And the boy said to him, listen, you have $1. I'll give you 2 quarters for your $1. The little boy said, oh, it's a good deal, 2 for 1. And he took the 2 quarters for the $1. A few minutes later, he met another boy. And that boy said to him, ooh, you have 2 quarters. Well, I have 3 dimes. I'll give you 3 dimes for your 2 quarters. He took that deal. Another boy met him with 4 nickels. He took that deal. At the end of the day, he comes back with 5 shiny pennies in his hand, opens his fist to his father, and his father turns red. The little boy assumed his father turned red because his father was so proud of the wisdom of his son. Okay. The reason why I share that anecdote with you is because money has no innate value. Money is representative of value. If you understand the exchange rate, if you understand the value that you could purchase with it, money has value. But money requires a higher order of thinking to recognize and requires a certain level of wisdom to recognize its value. The Chafetz Chaim once gave an interesting mushel. He said there was once a peasant who was selling his wheat to a merchant. And the way the merchant would count the wheat was as follows. He told the peasant, bring in your wheat, put it into the warehouse, and for each bag of wheat that you put down, I'll put a dollar coin in the plate. When we're done the transaction, we'll count up all the dollars, and for each bag of wheat that you've brought in, I'll exchange the 1 coin for $100. This is the way we count. That, in fact, was the deal. The peasant farmer began bringing in the bags. He brings in 1 bag. The merchant puts down a dollar. He brings in a second. The merchant puts down another silver dollar. And one after another after another. At a certain point, the merchant walks out. And he comes back in a few minutes later and sees that the plate is half empty. Of the many silver dollars that he put in, the peasant had stolen them. And he recognized that the peasant was actually taking those dollars. And he watched and he saw that, in fact, what happened. Every time the peasant would bring in a bag or two, the peasant would look. And when the peasant saw that the merchant wasn't looking, the peasant would reach into the plate and take away a dollar. That is an example, says the Chafetz Chaim, of foolishness. Why? Because each dollar in that plate is representative of $100. When he's reaching into that plate to take the dollar, he's not gaining. In his greed, he's costing himself because each single dollar represents a much larger value. This is a concept that I think is rather obvious, and that is that not every value is perceived at the simplest level of understanding, and there are certain levels of understanding that are necessary to relate to higher levels of value. And that's something we all understand. But I think there's an application of this that is very, very telling. I was once speaking with a gentleman. He came to speak to me about a marriage problem that he was having, and he was going on and on. His wife is insensitive, his wife doesn't really care, and look at this that she did, look at this that she did. And after 15 minutes, I turned to him and said, your problem is not your marriage. Your problem is not your wife's sensitivities. Your problem is your depression. You see, it became very clear that he was suffering from depression, and because of that, he was hypersensitive, and because of that, everything that his wife said caused him to feel tremendous pain. But his problem wasn't his marriage. His problem was his own matzav ruach, his own sense of self, his own emotional state. And the reason why this is very significant is because I then told him the following words. Your real problem now is going to be that you're too smart. You see, he was a very intelligent person. And what I explained to him was as follows. You're probably smarter than your psychologist. You're probably smarter than most people you know. I don't want to tell him he's probably smarter than me, but I think it might be true also. But here's the problem, I said to him. Despite the fact that you're so smart, it doesn't change the fact that you're looking at the world with black glasses. And if you're depressed, your brilliance, your insight is not going to help, because you're looking at the world through very, very gray, dark glasses, and you're therefore going to reach very wrong conclusions. And I think it's a rather interesting observation that our emotional state affects our value system. You see, even if I'm wise and I understand exchange rates, even if I'm knowledgeable and I understand the value innately of something, if I'm emotionally affected, that's going to change my value system. If you've ever spoken to a paranoid person, he doesn't walk around saying, well, there's no cause for me to be afraid. Quite the opposite. Didn't you see that cop? Didn't you see, I just want to walk by him, he touched his gun. Why did he do that? Didn't you see the mailman? He reached for his pepper spray. Why was he doing that? If it wasn't out to get me, why is he doing that? And the paranoid person will bring you an entire litany of events and occurrences to support his fear. You see, the way I feel greatly influences my value system, the way I assess situations, the way I look at the world. And just like my intellect changes my value system, so too does my psychological basis, as do my emotions. If you've ever seen a person in a road rage, they don't get out of the car and say, I'm out of control. There's no cause for my anger, but I'm going to punch you in the jaw. You're a cretin! You're a worthless creep! I should just, like, so you never should have existed. He'll give you an entire litany, an entire philosophy, and why your existence is not worth continuing. And it's rather interesting that all of the emotions that we experience aren't just things that we feel. They change the way we think about things. They change the way we understand things. As a matter of fact, if you ever pay attention to your thoughts, when you feel jealous, it's not just that you feel jealousy, you now look at the world differently. When you're jealous of another person, you view them with a different understanding, a different approach. You define that relationship differently, and you understand things much differently. And I think this is a tremendous concept. We usually think that our understanding, our psychological basis, and our emotions are three unrelated parts. And the reality is that they're tied together very, very tightly. If I feel something, I'm going to understand it differently. If I'm angry at you, I'm going to define our relationship differently. I'm going to view you differently, and I'm going to understand the situation in a different way. If I'm depressed, I'm going to view it differently. It's not just that my emotionality changes, my very understanding changes. And I believe that's exactly the answer to Rabbi Akiva. You see, had Rabbi Akiva delivered the following message to Ternofus, you're insulting God. You know why? Look, you're calling a piece of wood God. And Ternofus would have said, that's interesting, but he never would have felt it. What Rabbi Akiva did was he explained to Ternofus in a language that Ternofus could understand. When he said to Ternofus, I had a dream about two dogs. One was named Rufus, another Rufina. And Ternofus became furious the affront to the monarchy. Do you know I'm the king? Do you know I could take off your head without even thinking about it? You call me like a dog by my name? Turnufus felt fury. And when he felt that anger, then Rabbi Akiva said to him, aha, you see the affront that you feel? Now I want you to understand that's the affront that you constantly bombard God with. But you see, it was only when he felt it that he could understand it. The emotion greatly impacted his understanding. And the reason why Rabbi Akiva had to go through this entire charade is so Turnufus could feel it, so that he could understand it, because our feelings greatly impact the way we view things, our value system, our entire way of assessing things, and the way we understand life. The Chovos Levavos says, self-knowledge is wisdom. And when you understand that my emotions affect not just the way I feel, but they affect greatly the way I value things, the way I understand things, you begin to understand yourself on a deeper level. Why is it that sometimes I feel one way and sometimes I feel another way is one question, but a much bigger question is, why is it that sometimes I understand things in vastly different manners? And why is it that there'll be times when I look at the world with a vastly different way of viewing it than I do at other times? And when you begin to understand that the way I feel emotionally greatly impacts the way I understand things, you begin to understand yourself on a more deep level. That being said, I'd like to share with you one simple observation. The hallmarks of ADD are typically distractibility, impetuousness, and hyperactivity. Let's deal with two of them. If you've ever dealt with a hyperactive child, the hyperactivity is one issue, but there's a rather strange impulsiveness. Impulsivity means by the time the child doesn't even think, he's reached into your pocket, pulled out your pen, and is writing with it. The typical child will think 6 times before reaching into an adult's pocket. The ADD child is impulsive. He first pulls out the pen and writes with it, and only after the fact does he think about, should I have done that or should I have not done that? Distractibility is also a similar sort of phenomena. You ever hear the little jingle? ADD, 1, 2, 3. It's as easy as... Was that a butterfly? You see, there's an executive part of the brain that controls the thought process that's somewhat weakened and not functioning as well in the ADD child. Hence, distractibility, because any sound, any noise pulls away the attention. Distractibility and impulsivity. The reason I say that is because I believe the hallmarks of our current generation is exactly that. We are the ADD generation, and the manifestation of impulsivity and distractibility is manifest throughout the entire culture. And I'd like to share with you a couple of examples of this. This past week, I was in Disneyland. Every year I go down to Florida. I speak in a number of places. My father spends the winter there, and typically I take one of my children with me. Part of the time is work, and then I take one of the kids to Disneyland. Okay, I'm in Disney World over there in Florida, and I got a chance to play observant Jew. I observed. And if you look around the crowd, you probably note the following. Number one, it was an empty day in the park. There were only 23,000 people there. A busy peak day has 75,000 people. So because it was not as busy, we didn't have to wait on lines, and I got a chance to watch people a little bit more. And here's what I noticed. Everyone was fat. 65% of this country is overweight or obese. And the only thing that bulges more than their bellies is their wallets with credit cards on revolving credit lines that they've overspent. Would you like to know what I'm referring to? The average family, when they go to Disneyland, spends between $3,000 and $5,000. Now, here's an observation. Because I'm a frum person, I own a home in a frum neighborhood, and I have a reasonably large family, and I pay private tuition. So I can safely tell you that when I look around the park, I earn more money each year than at least 80% of the people coming to Disney World. How do I know that? Because they're UPS drivers, middle-level managers. They're not very, very wealthy people. They're your average run-of-the-mill individual who lives in this country. And yet they're spending between $3,000 and $5,000 on this vacation. When I take my daughter, we take our own food to the park. Not because there isn't kosher food, but because I can't afford it. We stayed in the most modest hotel, and the only reason we stayed in a Disney hotel was because it was 30% off offered. These people stay in very expensive hotels, eat in all the restaurants, and you have to ask yourself the following question. How do they afford it? And the answer really is quite simple. They can't afford it. They follow the consumer edict, which is charge. They put it on the credit card, and that's where it stays until mommy and daddy pay 12 to 18% interest rates. They'll pay it off over 3 to 5 years so the little child can have the Disney vacation of their lifetime. Okay, now I'd like to explain to you something that I find very, very eye-opening. Number one, I've taken 3 out of my 6 children to Disney World. The 3 who did not go, Baruch Hashem, still have developed good, healthy psyches. They're solid citizens, and they're well-developed children. And you may wonder how that could be. And if you follow the credo of the American culture, you'll probably say it can't be, because they didn't have the Disney experience. And they weren't there with Mickey Mouse. They weren't there in the park. And if you think I'm kidding, listen carefully to the commercials and understand why it is that parents will spend that untold amount of money. You see, this country takes fun right now very, very seriously. But they take fun so seriously that it hits a certain parity level. It hits a certain level when you realize something's funny, something's a little strange. America has gone from a land that valued thrift and hard work to a land that values fun. And the driving force now in much of the culture is that single theme. If you're not sure I'm right, by the way, Skippy peanut butter. You know how they sell Skippy peanut butter? Fuel the fun. You see, mothers used to give their children food as the energy source for what their children did. But what do their children do? What does mommy want for a child to have out of life? Fun. Now, gentlemen, let's not make any mistake. Fun is very important. It's a very good idea to enjoy life. It allows you to be a happy individual, allows you to reach goals, allows you to accomplish what you're put on the planet for. But if the tachlis, if the purpose of everything you do is fun, what you quickly find is that life is rather shallow, rather empty, and you begin living a strange sort of existence. I'd like to share with you an interesting observation about life in these times. I believe that in the 1960s, society, the American culture, underwent a revolution. We went from a society that revered elderly, that looked up to the elders as people of wisdom, and in the counterculture revolution of the 60s, all of that turned around. Anyone over 30 was suspect, was part of the establishment, had to be disregarded. After the 1960s, we became a youth-oriented culture. In the 1980s, it got dumbed down a little bit, and we no longer were a youth-oriented culture, and we were then a juvenile-oriented culture. And in the 21st century, I believe we've now hit the level of infantile. When I say infantile, what I mean is when you listen to TV programs focused on children, and I've heard exactly these words, you could have a lot of fun home with mommy, but you could have even more fun in school. And it's almost like the driving force of everything that happens is fun. And if you think I'm off base, let me share with you one observation. If you'd like a window into the culture, pay attention to Madison Avenue. Because Madison Avenue sells, and when they sell, they make money. They understand the psychology, they hit the hot buttons, and listen carefully to how Madison Avenue sells the American dream. The American dream used to be owning a home in the suburbs with a white picket fence, 1.5 kids, and a dog. That used to be the American dream. That is no longer the American dream. The American dream is selling your business, retiring, and playing all day. That's success. I sold my business, and I play. And if you pay attention to the undercurrents, you'll see that that is considered making it. That's the ultimate success. That's what everyone wants. I once heard Rav Noach Weinberg make an interesting observation. He said as follows. If you have a young boy, a five-year-old, and the five-year-old acts like a two-year-old, it's a very real serious concern, and you begin putting that child under careful observation because you have to deal with the issue. If that child at the age of 10 acts like a five-year-old, then it's time for intervention. It's time to really get involved in seeing what you could do to help the child. When you have a 15-year-old who acts like a 7-year-old, it's time to seriously consider institutionalizing the child because he can't function in society. But what happens when you have a 65-year-old who acts like he's 15? That's called retirement. You see, when you retire, what do? You play all day. And I've gone to retirement communities, and I've heard 7-year-olds. I heard a 7-year-old woman say to me, it's like day camp all day for adults. All we do is play. And if it sounds humorous, what I'm telling you is pay careful attention to the undercurrents in society. And what you hear is the goal, the ultimate success, is to finally have no responsibilities and be able to play all day. And as funny as that sounds, I'm afraid to say it is very much what's out there in the world and very much as to what's considered the ultimate goal. Benjamin Franklin, one of the founders of this country, had an interesting line. He said, retirement is fine as long as it doesn't interfere with your work. You see, if you have a reason for existence, if you have a purpose, if you're accomplishing great things, then it's okay to retire from your 9-to-5 because you're going to be engaged in very significant, important things. But if the focus of life is fun, and the focus of life is playing, and you retire and play, you find yourself in a very interesting state. And I want to re-mention again, there's nothing wrong with having fun. Having fun is a very good idea to help you do a better job at this thing called life, to make you happier, to allow you to live life better. But it sure ain't the purpose of it all. Now, if you're not sure that I'm right about this fact that the United States of America suffers from impulsivity and distractibility, I'll share with you one simple thought. If you watch a professional football game, you will probably find an awful lot of stuff going on. 174 minutes of an average broadcast. How much of that broadcast, of the almost 3 hours, is actual football playing? The answer is 11 minutes. And I'll explain to you why. You see, in the 1970s, televising a professional football game involved putting a camera on the field. They would basically start the camera at the beginning, first kickoff, and that's what you'd be watching on TV, exactly what was happening on the field. The problem is it got too boring. So right now, NBC shows up with between 7 and 8 full crews, full trucks, between 80 and 200 crew members. The cost of presenting a football game now is between $150,000 and $250,000. And what you're seeing is constant motion. A play, then stop, replay, back to instant play, back to the scrimmage, back to the huddle, focus on the owner, focus on everything but the actual activity. Of 3 hours is only 11 minutes of actual play because it would be too boring to actually watch the game. And I think it's just one manifestation of this interesting phenomenon that we've become the crackberry generation. We've become so distracted, so constantly inundated by needing more and distractibility and more things that even watching a football game can't be done in live, actual time. It's got to be cut, 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 back and forth. Now, I believe that this phenomena is something that you'll see throughout the culture, throughout the times, a tremendous focus on this thing. And you may ask me, so what is the cost of it? What is the cost of this being the focal point? So I'd like to share with you that there are two costs. If you're a secular individual, there is one cost, and for us, there's a different cost. If you're a secular individual, the cost is very interesting. What happens when your child sits down to a big, hearty meal of cotton candy? Your child sits down to eat cotton candy after cotton candy cone after cotton cone, and then stuffs it down with a couple of Snicker bars and then a few Milky Ways and then one or two Kit Kats to finish off the meal. Besides the stomach ache, what your child is going to feel is sick. And after a half hour, your child is going to be more hungry than your child was before he or she began eating. And would you like to know why? Because when you eat a diet of candy and sugar, it doesn't fill you. It doesn't satisfy you. We live in very strange times. Never in the course of history, never in the course of humanity was there so much available. Never was there so much opulence. Never was there so much freedom and opportunity. Never did the average person have in front of him everything he could ever dream of and more. The luxuries, the opportunities have never been greater. You would imagine that mankind has finally arrived. We no longer suffer from marauders, no longer suffer from the Black Plague. We have everything that we've ever dreamt of. You would imagine that man has finally achieved the state of happiness. Yet if you look around the American scene today, that's not quite what you see. You don't see people reaching true satisfaction and happiness. And if you're not sure that I'm right, test me on this one. Google the word happiness. When you Google the word happiness, you'll find at least 5 million websites selling happiness. Buy happiness for $9.95 a month. We'll sell you our program to be happy. Buy our book and you'll be happy. You'll be really happy if you use our program. Why is it that over 5 million websites are selling happiness? Because the vast mass of humanity out there are not happy. And you know why they're not happy? Because when you understand that the human being was created for a purpose, the human being was created to grow, to accomplish, to do great things, and then you try to lead a life of fun, when you fill yourself with cotton candy all day, you're empty at the core of your existence. You feel a total lack of satisfaction. And you could have a generation of wealth, opulence, freedom, opportunity, and people who live a vacuum of existence. And I believe that's the cost of the fun generation, the ADD generation, to a secular person. But the cost to us is a lot greater. You ever walk into Walmart to buy a quart of milk and walk out with 20 other things in your cart? What if you walk into Walmart? What if you walk into Walmart and instead of buying a milk and an entire cart of things, you never walk out of Walmart and you spend hour upon hour upon hour there? I'd like to share with you one interesting thought. To us as thinking... That's my phone. I can't even say, please shut off your phone and put it on stun. Did I say distractibility? ADD? I'd like to share with you three thoughts. I believe these three thoughts will change your life. Thought number one is the following. I, not somebody else, not my distant cousin, not my old uncle, I one day will die. I, the one I'm speaking to you, will one day leave this earth. And that is a huge step forward in understanding. Because when I understand that it is I who will leave this earth, not some other person, not my uncle, not my older cousin, but me, I begin looking at life in a very different manner. The tinsel, the fun, the sort of loose, sort of not focused way of viewing life changes dramatically. But there's another thought that I'd like to share with you. Thought number two that I think will do a lot to change your perspective on life is that when we die, we're not a bunch of angels. If you ask the average person, when you die, what's going to happen? So it's okay. I'm good. You're good. It's all good. We'll all be up there with our wings and we'll all be angels. And it's all good because we're all together there. I'd like to share with you that that's patently false. That is absolutely inaccurate. When I die, when you die, we will be there, but we'll be on vastly different levels. Every human being will be exactly what they shape themselves into. If you grew, if you accomplished, you'll be a sterling, brilliant giant. And if you didn't, you'll be a Lilliputian, you'll be a splinter of a man. But we're not all there together, all angels with our wings hanging out together. It will be vastly different, and for eternity will be exactly what we shaped ourselves into. So if thought number one is that I am going to die, and thought number two is that I will be exactly what I shaped myself into, here is thought number three. Thought number three is that I can change. I can change, use my time differently, accomplish different things, and become a different person. Would you like to know what the real danger to us of living in this current generation? There's no anti-Semitism that we experience on a daily basis. There are no Gentiles who are throwing rocks in our windows. We live in freedom, we have opportunity, and we have money. Would you like to know the danger for us living in this times? It's this distractibility, this impulsivity. And when you live in a world where there's such tinsel and there's fireworks going all over all the time, you're living in Disneyland. And when you're living in Disneyland, the fun is going to go on forever. And fun is the purpose of it. And one day I'm going to retire, sell my business, buy a yacht, and have fun all day. And when the culture you live in speaks that way, and when the culture you live in speaks that message very clearly, you get pulled into it, and you get drawn into it, and you forget you're here for a purpose. You forget there's a mission, and you forget there's an end. You forget that you were put here for a few short years to grow, to accomplish. You get lost in the fun. You think the current situation will last forever, and you end up with a very, very perverted version of life. My friends, I don't know if you appreciate what I'm saying to you. There was once upon a time a generation of people who worked very, very hard, who were very, very focused, who spent years on goals, accomplishing, growing. That's not the current climate out there. I'll give you an example from a rather almost perverse example. Would you like to know that there are no Bali Taiva left in our generation? There used to be a man who was a Bal Taiva. A Bal Taiva means a person who's consumed by passion and lives with passion. Would you like to see an example? The Gemara tells us about Eloza Badudia. Eloza Badudia had the reputation of having lived with every zona in the world, any prostitute he visited, to the extent that he one time heard of a prostitute at a certain, she lived in a certain island, and she charged an entire bag full of gold as her cost. He heard about this prostitute. The Gemara tells us he crossed seven rivers. He went on a long and difficult journey, took his entire purse of gold and paid this prostitute for that opportunity. That's a man who is a Bal Taiva. That's a man who lives for passion. It may be perverted, it may be perverse, but that's a man. And would you like to know what the end of that man was? Once he understood the futility of his ways, he changed like that, and he became a vastly different individual. He left this earth as Rebbe Elazar Bar Dudya. But because he was a man, granted he turned off, but he had the capacity to then turn around. When you live a life of distraction, when you live a life of impulsivity, you're not even a Bal Taiva. You're not even giving into your passions. It's whatever comes first, whatever is natural, whatever is right in front of you. I won't even get off my couch for desire or passion. If it's here, I'll do it, but I won't even leave my living room. And as strange as it sounds, we live in a very, very cushy, very, very cotton candy culture, and the fun will never end. The cost, from a secular perspective, is it's very difficult to enjoy life. It's very difficult to set goals. It's very difficult to be a happy individual when you're stuffing yourself with cotton candy all day. The real cost to us as growing, thinking people is far more. And that cost is we get lost in the glitter, we get lost in the cotton candy, we get lost in the fireworks. And what happens is we lose perspective. And as strange as it sounds, we forget why we're here, we forget about growing, and we lose our focus on life. I think there's a tremendous lesson to learn from Rabbi Akiva. And that lesson is that he told Turnus Rufus an entire charade. When Turnus Rufus asked, why does your God hate us? Rabbi Akiva didn't just say, because you call a piece of wood God. He said, I had a dream about the two dogs. Why did he say that? Because he wanted Turnus Rufus to feel it. When Turnus Rufus felt the affront, when he felt the anger, then Rabbi Akiva could say, aha, you feel that? That pain that you feel, that affront, that anger, now multiply that 10,000, that's the affront that God, the creator of the heavens and the earth, should feel. But it wasn't until Rabbi Akiva felt it, it wasn't until Turnus felt it, that he could convey that sense of understanding, because our feelings, our emotions, dramatically impact our understanding. like that child who exchanged $1 for two quarters for five dimes. He didn't understand the value of the currency. Wisdom will greatly impact the value that you have for things. If you spend many years learning about the value of mitzvahs, if you spend many years learning about the value of relationships, but then you get angry, a very interesting thing happens. I'm furious at you. You're no longer a human being. You're no longer a person I regard. And now that I feel differently, I understand things differently, my value system changes. Just like my understanding changes my value systems, and my emotions change my value systems. And when you feel differently about something, you understand it differently. When you live in a fun generation where the focus of everything is party, let's just have a good time because fun is the purpose. The real cost is you no longer understand the value of things. You no longer understand the value of time. You no longer understand the value of accomplishments. You no longer set goals because you're lost in the tinsel, you're lost in the Disneyland, and you no longer understand. I'd like to share with you that if you would like to grow, there is really only one single guaranteed technique that can solve this. It doesn't work for everyone, it doesn't work all the time, but learning Mussar. You see, learning Mussar from a Mussar Sefer is a very, very powerful tool. Would you like to know what the great accomplishment of learning Mussar is? It allows me to feel things differently, and when I feel things differently, I understand them differently. When I'm living in the tinsel, when I'm living in this world of gain some money, gain some honor, and then have fun, to ground yourself requires feeling it. Feeling the gravity of a moment, feeling the accomplishment, feeling the real purpose of life. Once you feel it, you understand it. But the only way that a person can really, on a regular basis, stay grounded is by learning Mussar. When you learn Mussar, you feel things. When you feel things, you understand it, and you view life differently. I remember very clearly the words of my Rebbe, the Rosh Yeshiva Zatzal, who said over and over, you have to learn Mussar every day. You have to learn Mussar every day. It rings in my mind like a bell. And I'd like to share with you that in my own life, there were times when I didn't learn Mussar every day. I remember clearly at Tkufa, I was a Rebbe in the high school. I spent many hours preparing for Shir, spent many hours learning with the guys. I was very involved in learning, but for whatever which reason, I wasn't learning Mussar on a regular basis. And I was a different person. I felt differently about things. I made mistakes. I didn't react the same way. And if you would like to grow, if you would like to accomplish, if you would like to reach levels for which you were put on the planet for, you have to attach yourself to a Mussar Sefer. You have to grow. You have to accomplish. You have to make it part of yourself. I am, in Mitzvah Hashem, beginning a program of daily Mussar Shir. I'd like to welcome you to join me in that. It'll be online within less than a month. In Mitzvah Hashem, please pay attention for it. It'll be a 20-minute daily Mussar, starting with Mitzvah Sharm. I'd like to welcome you to join because I think it is a powerful, life-changing thing. If you ever wake up one day and feel something, and therefore understand it and want to hold that, if you want to keep it, it's only through this process of constantly learning. I think Rabbi Akiva was teaching a tremendous lesson to Tarnofos, and that lesson is feelings change, not just the way you feel about things, change the way you understand things. When you understand things differently, you relate to them differently. And my friends, I'd like to close with one last observation. You can be brilliant, you could be insightful, you could be a philosopher, but you could live your life like a blind bat. And if you'd like an example of that, and let's look at Tarnofos HaRosha. The man was a soldier philosopher, the man was a monarch, and the man was highly intelligent. Yet I'd like to share with you in another exchange that he had with Rabbi Akiva. And one day he meets Rabbi Akiva, and he says to Rabbi Akiva as follows, "Mayom miyom mayim, what is today of all days?" And Rabbi Akiva answers him, "And what are you of all men?" At which point Tarnofos realized he was being challenged. And he said to Rabbi Akiva, "What did I say and what did you say?" And Rabbi Akiva said, "Simply, you asked me what is today of all days, why is Shabbos different than all days of the week? I said to you, and what makes you distinct from all men of the Roman Empire?" Tarnofos said, "Okay, fine, I'll tell you the answer. What makes me distinct is I was chosen to be the monarch." And Rabbi Akiva said, "Well, this day was chosen by God to be the day of all days." And Tarnofos said to him, "Fine, prove that to me." And Rabbi Akiva said, you want a proof? I'll prove it to you. Ask your father. Tanofas' father was dead already. However, Tanofas was skilled in something called Negida, bringing up the dead, and apparently it was something that he engaged in. And it was an occasion not long after that when, in fact, Tanofas brought up his father. He brought him up on Monday, on Tuesday, on Wednesday, on Thursday. When it came to Shabbos, his father didn't come to him. Sunday, he again brought up his father, and he said to his father, what happened? You died and became Jewish? You keep the Shabbos? And his father said to him, if you, those who don't keep the Shabbos in your world, against their will, have to keep Shabbos in this world. And Tanofas said, what do you mean you have to keep the Shabbos? What do you do all week? And so his father said, well, simply what they do all week to me is they burn me. I'm engaged in that process on the Shabbos. They don't burn me. I don't have to be involved in that. But I'm not allowed to leave where I am. I'd like to share with you what Tanofas heard. What Tanofas heard from the mouth of his father was that his father was burning in Gehenna. His father was burning Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, and on Shabbos was allowed not to burn. Those are the words that he heard from his own father, at which point you would assume that Tanofas became an instant Baal Tshuva, turned around his life, and became a vastly different human being. Unfortunately, though, that's not the rest of the story. Tanofas HaRosha is the man who presided over the killing of Rabbi Akiva. Not only did he preside over the killing of Rabbi Akiva, he was the one who chose the method to kill Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva was to be skinned alive. His skin was literally to be pulled off of his body while he was still alive, and he was to die from that death. And the Gemara tells us the event that Tanofas witnessed. They were literally pulling the skin off Rabbi Akiva, and he didn't utter a sound until they got to the place of tefillin. And when they ripped the skin off the place of his tefillin, Rabbi Akiva began laughing. And Tanofas said these words, Saba, Saba, grandfather, grandfather, are you insane? How could you laugh at this moment? And Rabbi Akiva said these words, every day of my life I've said the pasuk, V'ahavta Hashem lekecha b'chol levavcha, b'chol nafshecha, b'chol miyadecha. Hashem, I love you with all of my heart, ready to give up my life with all of my money. All of the days of my life, I knew that I loved Hashem with all of my heart. I knew I was prepared to give up all of my money. And never once have I had this opportunity to now actually give up my life for Hashem. Shouldn't I laugh? And very shortly thereafter, Rabbi Akiva left this world. I don't know if there was a more heroic death. I don't know if there was a greater transcendence of human instinct than Rabbi Akiva at that moment. And not only didn't Tanofas get it, Tanofas left this earth as a Rasha, as a wicked individual, never once discovering the truth. And the reason I share that with you is because, again, you can be highly intelligent, but if your value system is off, because you have emotions that mess with it, if you have a version of the world that's skewed, if you have a version of understanding that causes you to view things differently, your brilliance, your intelligence will fail you. And the only way that a person could ever reach real heights is by making sure that they feel the things they're supposed to feel, and make sure that their heart and mind is aligned. And when you feel things in their proper meaning, you value them properly, you understand why you're here, you grow, you accomplish, and at the end of your days, you have what to show for yourself. But you can have brilliance, you can have intelligence. If you don't learn to train yourself, if you don't learn to use your emotions properly, you'll never reach a quarter of your heights, you'll never become the individual you become. Hashem grant us wisdom and understanding to put this into practice.